We will call to order the Judiciary Committee of the House at 1:05 on Wednesday, the February 8th. Present are Representatives Davis, Bundy, Finkelstein, VC, and myself, Representative Porter. Representative Green, I'm sure, will be along momentarily, and Representative Toohey is testifying in another committee on a bill that she and I are jointly sponsoring, so I'll let her go. We have the first item on the agenda is continuation of HB 25, and if this is what I think it might be, there are two people who wish to testify from Anchorage on the bill, and one is not yet hooked up, and the other one is temporarily detained. With the permission of the committee, what I will do is take another bill right now, which I don't think will take too long, and then get into 25 when these other people hopefully are available. At least we'll give them some time to get hooked up. So with that in mind, I would like to begin the testimony on HB 74, assault by adults on children. The sponsor, Representative Bundy, is here. And we'll change chairs and tell us about his bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. HB 74 concerns an incident that most of you are probably familiar with, and I will briefly cover the bill, and I have both the victim that was involved in this incident and his aunt here, and I'd like to then go over to them for their testimony. What had happened is that Sean was attacked by three adults. The charge that was brought against those adults was a misdemeanor, and there was a general concern in the public that this was inappropriate. They would like to send a much stronger message that a felony charge should be brought in this type of a case. The law did not allow this to occur, and the bill before you fills that gap, allows prosecutors the discretion to bring a felony charge where there is the age difference. Current law affects those under the age of 10, and there is a gap between 10 and 16, and that's what this law addresses. In order to avoid unnecessary felony charges, as I stated, there is the flexibility for the prosecutor. And they can still charge people with a misdemeanor as they are under the current statutes if there isn't aggravating circumstances. And if the defendant reasonably believes that the victim was 16 or older, this provision would protect those that from having an unwarranted felony charge, and certainly would minimize the impact on the state. I would, if you have questions for me on the bill, I'd be happy to entertain those. If not, I'd like to turn my time over to Julie Jensen-Czar, a person who's been very active in this process of seeking redress through the legislation, and let her tell you her story, if you would.
As you have questions, thank you, Representative Bundy. Please come forward and welcome to the committee, Dwyer. Would you give us your name for the record so we can write it down, and your testimony, please?
Okay, Julie Jensen-Czar. I'm here today to ask for your support in passing House Bill 74. On November 11th at 5 a.m., while delivering the Anchorage Daily News, my 14-year-old nephew was assaulted. He was viciously assaulted by three adult men. They beat him. He lost two permanent teeth. He had neck trauma and was run over by his own snow machine. The way the law reads now, it was a misdemeanor. I brought pictures that I'd like to share. The picture on the front is Sean 2 weeks before this happened. On the three following pages are what my nephew looked like when I got to the hospital. Also included in the book are a crime alert that I started 2 days after it happened, using a computer at my brother's office, and distributed over 900 of them on cars all over Anchorage by myself. We then contacted Mr. Bundy and asked for him to support a change in the law. I moved to Anchorage in 1971 with my family, and I grew up out in South Anchorage. Back then, it was the most wonderful place to grow up. And back then, the law, as it reads now, probably fit. There weren't the crimes, the drive-by shootings, the assaults on kids and other people. The Anchorage of the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s just didn't have these kind of crimes. And as the crimes changed, so must the laws change to fit the crimes of 1995 and beyond. This event brought to light for me the need to make a difference and to try to turn a negative into a positive, teaching my nephew and my two children empowerment instead of victimization. The change in the law will show that through hard work, a belief in an idea, one person can have a positive impact on society. The outpour of support from the people of Anchorage has also had a healing effect on my nephew. Again, I ask for your support. I also brought with me over 1,000 signatures from the citizens of Anchorage. We have a lot more coming in. A lot of people still have the petitions out. And when I spoke to my husband, he said, they're calling and want to turn them in. But supporting House Bill 74. Thank you. For taking the time to listen.
Thank you. I see no questions. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Did fine.
Well, Sean, would you like to make some comments?
John, welcome. Would you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
I'm Virgil Jensen. I'm here this afternoon to ask for your support on House Bill 74. On the morning of November 9th, 1994, while delivering Anchorage Daily News, I was repeatedly assaulted by three men. I was thrown down, run over by my own snow machine, and this is a misdemeanor. Something obviously needs to be changed if three men can beat up a 14-year-old kid and get off with a hand slap. I have serious injuries that I have to live with for the rest of my life because I have two permanent missing teeth that won't ever grow back and mental pressure. The men who beat me will probably not remember this for very long, but I will. I've been seriously injured both physically and emotionally. This cowardly action on the part of three adults needs to be at least a felony on their record. I realize that the passage of this bill will not help my case. However, I will be satisfied to know that it will help others. Thank you.
John, thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to give testimony on HB 74? Mr. Bernard from the Department of Law. Welcome, Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dean Grinelli with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. We recently had the Mickey Company publish a book this thick on Alaska criminal laws, and after many years in the criminal justice system, you think that our laws cover just about everything, and then you run across a case like this that shows that there's a loophole in unusual circumstances, and I think that this bill plugs that loophole, and for that reason, I think it's it's something that's an appropriate change. I would like to make one proposed amendment, and that's to change a single word in the bill. And that word, actually, I have a single word. It would be on page 2, line 3, before the word causes, to add the word intentionally.
The word what?
Intentionally. And I made the suggestion for technical reasons. It has to do with the effect of alcohol intoxication and how that relates to the mental states used in Alaska law. And I could go into a detailed explanation of why that's so. But I think that this change certainly still makes this law usable. All assaults that are going to occur by adults against children are certainly going to be intentional, as most assaults are. I think that, as Representative Bundy said, this law continues to give prosecutors discretion to use this more serious offense or not to use it in certain cases. I'm not going to suggest that every time a high school senior who's 18 years old gets in a fight with a freshman who's 15 years old that we're going to charge that person with a felony. That's not going to happen. But in appropriate cases, like the case that this represents, it's something that it's a tool that prosecutors ought to be able to use. So with that, that testimony, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Turi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Fornelli, I was sneezing, actually, when you made a statement. The comment about alcohol, this does not, if the perpetrator or the adult is smashed out of his mind and he does this, that doesn't excuse it, does it? Is that what you were saying?
Alcohol intoxication, if it reaches a certain level, can allow someone to show that they didn't form the intent to do something. So that that is an excuse. What I'm referring to is under current law, when someone gets intoxicated and they drive a car and get in an accident, if people in the car are injured as a result of this accident, they can be charged with an assault. If a person is killed, it's manslaughter. If they're injured, they get charged with an assault. unless you insert this word intentionally, you end up with a situation where someone could get in a car wreck, and if there are children in the car who are injured, the person gets charged with a felony. If there are adults in the car who are injured, they get charged with a misdemeanor. And it creates a situation where two people doing essentially the same thing get charged with widely varying crimes. So that was the reason why I suggested this. And I really think that it covers all the cases that we want to cover, and it avoids some results that perhaps we want to avoid.
Is it a fair statement, Dave, for the clarification of the committee, that except in the situation that you've described, and I cannot think of any others, that intentional is an element of an assault anyway?
As a practical matter, it is. Yeah.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dean, I was a little concerned with your answer to Representative Tui's question, so that if a person is at the point 2, 3, or whatever it does, where you begin to lose your ability to form an intent, or not consciously, but you still perpetrate this act, does that mean that this will not apply? As amended?
As amended, if you can show that you didn't intend to do what you were doing, that you were so intoxicated. intoxication is a defense to any specific intent crime. It's a defense to theft crimes. It's a defense to other kinds of crimes that use the word intent. So,
well, I don't mean to belabor this point, but I'm incensed that if I go out and punch somebody out, that's a crime, a tort or whatever it is of intent. But if I drink enough and punch him out, I'm excused from that intent portion?
If the crime uses the specific element of intent, most of our crimes do not. There will still be some crime that you would be guilty of.
Well, my concern is that people will talk about their drinking escapades, and they'll say, "Well, I'm a moody drunk. I get to drinking and I get belligerent. I want to go fight or something." But I was so wasted, I didn't realize I hit Johnson right square in the nose. I mean, whoa.
It's proving that you didn't intend to do something like this raises what's called diminished capacity. I mean, it requires an expert coming in saying, a psychologist or psychiatrist saying, this person was so drunk he was unable to form an intent to steal the property, to drive the car, to assault the person, etc. That level of intoxication, that level of proof, very rarely occurs. So I don't expect that it's going to make any difference to 99% of the cases that we are going to encounter.
Well, except if I might on that point is thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is that had these three adults been to that point, then we wouldn't even be here talking about this because they would have had an excuse anyway.
Let me, if I may, another way of stating what Nina said is the flip side. Intoxication is not a defense. It's only grounds for mitigation of sentence. Unless that intoxication is at such a level that they have the inability to form the requisite intent to do that. I would submit that the fact situation of the case that we're talking about is prima facie evidence that would not have been reached because they could not have done all of those things and been so intoxicated as to reach this level of an inability to form an intent. There's just rare situations. I don't know, it sounds like a big loophole that we're creating here, but it's just, I've seen this defense raised myself in cases that I've handled, and it's just nigh on impossible.
Yes, well, I actually agree with unless somebody's got you and pouring your drinks down, it's your intent to drink and your intent to get sloshed. Without this bill, is it still as effective? Without this intentional?
Without that intentional, it's still effective. There may be rare cases where it leads to divergent results and that might be unfair, but. With the word in there or without the word in there, it's still going to be an effective piece of legislation.
Thank you. Thanks.
Any other questions, Dean? If not, Dean, thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on HB 74? And looking around, I recognize Representative Nicolai in the back and say welcome. I'd say come sit at the table, but we're all in the room. Well, I guess the first thing to deal with is the word, intentional. What's the wish of the committee? Representative Chair?
I'm opposed to it.
Okay.
Before we take the vote, could I ask one question?
Certainly may. Representative Davis.
What would be the unfairness, or what could be the unfairness of not putting, what would happen? What could happen? I need to weigh that before I make up my mind.
I think the, Chairman, Representative Davis, I think the unfairness that could result is also would also be a rare occurrence, and that's where someone is driving drunk, they hit a car, injure a child, and under the standard in the current version, that would be a felony. If they drove drunk, struck a car, injured an adult, that would be a misdemeanor. So you'd have two people essentially doing the same conduct, which is driving a car and striking something else, and one person is charged with a felony, another person is charged with a misdemeanor. And that situation is corrected by inserting that word. It potentially raises the question of someone who is, extremely intoxicated, going out and beating someone else up. But as Representative Porter says, that's a rare occurrence as well. I mean, what we're talking about is a rare occurrence where
either way,
and in this particular case where the facts have fit into a small loophole is also a rare occurrence. So we're talking about things that rarely happen.
Would the prosecutor have the ability to charge consistently in that rare occurrence on the other side rather than have to be guided by this?
Probably so.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Grinnelli's still there. I certainly don't want to make things more confusing, but being a novice in law, is there any way that you could do this, leaving intentionally in there, and at the end of that statement said that alcohol consumption is not a mitigating circumstance or something to that effect, so that we don't get into the problem of allowing somebody, because I know people who have driven across Los Angeles Basin, they can't even remember it. So they were capable of negotiating for a long time.
Right. I think that change would I'm not certain that the courts would accept that, because when you have to prove intent, there are a lot of things that can didn't intend to do something. And intoxication, the courts have held, is one of them. We may end up reversing a long line of court opinions. I think that this is such a rare occurrence that if you have it in there or you don't have it in there, it's not a major problem. And
let me ask the committee to cut to the chase here. Is there anyone who would like to offer that as an amendment? Seeing none, we have the bill in front of us. What's the wish of the committee? We have an amendment to interject the word intentionally between on line 3, page 2, between odor and causes. It would then read older, comma, intentionally causes. There has been objection. Is there discussion? Can we have a roll call vote on the amendment, please?
Representative Finkelstein?
Yes.
Representative Tui?
No.
Representative Vesey?
Yes.
Representative Davis?
No.
Representative Bundy?
No.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Porter?
No. The amendment fails. Chair would entertain a motion on the bill. Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would recommend that
House Bill 74, A version. We moved out of committee with unanimous consent, and
Object.
There's an objection. Can we have a roll call vote, please?
Yes.
Representative Bundy?
Yes.
Representative Davis?
Yes.
Representative Lindsay?
No.
Representative Davidson?
Yes.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Porter?
Yes.
HB 74 is moved. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'm informed that we have the people that we wanted to have available for HB 25. So we'll begin the testimony on that bill. For information of those people testifying and the committee, the we have a work draft version R, Romeo, dated 2395, but we haven't adopted yet, but I think we'll be working on that. And with that in mind, is Mr. Corkill on the teleconference network?
Mr. Chairman, do you want me to move the move back? Is it working back?
We can take this test from here. I'll say again, is Mr. Corkill available in Fairbanks?
Yes, yes, I am.
Could we have your testimony on HB 25, please? And could you give us your full name and affiliation?
My name is Michael J. Corkill. My affiliation is Press for the Alaska Peace Officers Association. First of all,
Michael, you faded out there. Are you still with us?
Yes, I'm finished.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike. Are there any questions of the committee? Seeing none, Mike, thank you very much. Is Cindy Strout available in Anchorage?
Yes, I am.
Cindy, could you give us your full name and affiliation for the record, please, and then your testimony?
Yes, my name is Cindy Strout, and I'm an attorney of private practice in Anchorage.
Discovery is not made available to defendants.
there will be many more defendants that go to trial or that file pre-trial motions that they might not file simply to get discovery. And the money will be churned out in that process rather than an exchange knowing what the evidence is against in regard to having attorneys who can then adequately advise them of what their chances are at trial. When you have to go to trial not knowing the evidence against you, I think many, many more people will exercise their trial rights if they can find out. So I would encourage the commission to think about the cost involved in this and the consequences of proceeding to trial under the opt-out provision. And the staff that the resources have to be, that I think will be spent unnecessarily by enacting many of the portions of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Are there any questions, David, Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What would be the impact on the kind of clients you have for the one of the changes in here where the information can't be made available, copies can't be given to anybody, can't give them to the defendant? I think I'm looking at the wrong version again. If you could, I'm talking about on page 9, the changes made and what's made available.
Here's your line 14.
These line 9, line 14, and the change there is to say that these items, used to be that these items weren't available if they fit these particular areas, and by eliminating that, it's hard to read the sentence now, shall be subject to the other terms and conditions that the court may provide. So all information would now be under that category.
Yeah, that's your question. I don't think I think the intent of the change in the law here is to prevent a criminal defendant from obtaining confidential information regarding witnesses and or victims. And I don't see that as a major problem as long as it doesn't impact the defendant's ability to communicate to the defendant what the evidence is against him or her. I think my reading of this is the intent is that the defendant not physically have control of that information, for example, phone numbers or addresses, and unless that is in some way critically relevant to our defense, and then I think under those conditions the defense could apply for a court order or something, but I don't see that as particularly intrusive.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I may misunderstand it, but the way it's written currently, it keeps that confidential information, confidential materials can't be provided, and my understanding of the change is that it goes to include all information. And the concern we had was for, especially in the case of public defender, where they're dealing with large numbers of clients, that the inability to give any of the, even the police report with witnesses' names removed, if you can't give that to the client, there'd be a workload problem because you'd have to go and have somebody sit there with them. In your experience in private practice, is that as much of a problem?
Probably not as much of a problem. However, I did work with the Public Defender Agency, and I certainly agree that that could be very difficult for any attorney with a large case or a complex case where there are volumes of material that, in my experience, I have some clients that want to read every single word there is and other clients that don't. And to have to sit with a defendant while reading volumes of reports certainly would add to the expense in public cases. Attorney time being paid for at public expense while sitting in a little room while someone reads something does seem probably unnecessary if the confidential information can be deleted in a way to protect privacy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any other questions of Cindy? If not, Cindy, thank you very much. I have an indication that perhaps Sue Ellen Chatter was available for testimony. And I see her shaking her head in the back, so I guess Sue Ellen is not available. Is there anyone else on the teleconference network that wishes to give testimony on HB 25? Hearing none. Mr. Guarnelli.
Am I being requested?
I think so. Dean, welcome back. For the record.
My name is still Dean Guarnelli.
Consistency is this.
I had no prepared testimony. I'm certainly willing to answer questions about the, I guess the R draft is what we're working from
yes.
at this point.
And this would be an appropriate time, Representative Bundy, actually, for your motion.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity. I move that we adopt the CS for House Bill 25.
Version R?
Version R as a working draft. Thank you.
Is there discussion of some Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we adopt it, if we could just have someone quickly explain those differences from the previous draft. We did get a very helpful memo which explained it versus existing law, but I still haven't yet figured out what substantial changes were made from the previous draft.
Perhaps, Dean, could you help us with that, or are you that familiar with this draft?
Well, there was a change made to the provisions for expert witnesses, one of which occurs on page 4, lines 8 to 9, and the other change, there's a similar change that occurs on page 6, lines 13 and 14, and essentially what both those changes do is to require that in addition to giving a name and address of the expert, the expert also provide a report. This is something that the prosecution experts almost always do. Defense experts never do. In fact, defense attorneys will instruct or request the experts not to write a report so that the prosecution doesn't have anything. This is something that I heard Mr. Salemi indicate. I don't think he has an objection to. I understood Cynthia Strauss' testimony to be that it was a good idea to give notice of experts and copies of their reports. So that change is reflected in this draft. In other words, not only will you provide the name and address of the expert, but the expert shall provide a written report of any of the tests conducted, if any, and the conclusions reached by the expert. That change was inserted into the bill at pages 4 and 6, but unfortunately the other language that was in there that attempted to do something similar was not taken out, and that's the language that follows immediately, which on page 4 at lines 10 and 11 it says, the prosecutor shall also make available for inspection copying any other reports or written statements of these experts. I'm not certain exactly what that does, and it certainly could be interpreted to be any other reports in any other cases the expert has ever done, which is inappropriate. And there's something similar on page 6 at lines 15 and 16. So I think that was a matter of when it got drafted up, something was added and something should have been deleted but was not.
Could you go to those again? Page 4, line...
page 4, line... 10 to 11, starting with the prosecutor shall also make, and to the end of that that clause. And then on line 15 and 16, it's a complete sentence. Page 6, lines 15 and 16, the defendant shall also make available for inspection.
So you're suggesting that
but those two can, they should have been deleted.
Okay, well, so I was just going to say the same thing. One case is prosecuted, the other is defendant. It's just play, level playing field.
Yes, that's correct. Okay. That's correct.
Mr. Chairman, would you like to take a friendly amendment on that?
I would imagine so. Want to try to form it?
Yes.
Amendment number one.
Let me delete, I'm sorry. Delete, as Mr. Guarnelli said, line 10, starting with the words, the prosecutor shall, I'm sorry, on page 4, line 10 to line 11. Remove those.
From the words, the prosecutor shall, to the words on the plural of these experts, yes,
right.
Okay.
And then on page 6, line 15, from the word, the defendant shall, to these experts on line 16. Remove these, delete
those. Representative
Fenstein? Mr. Chairman, just so we get things in the right order, does Mr. Guarnelli, has he finished with his description of the changes?
There was one other change that I'm aware of, Mr. Chairman, and that...
Let's deal with this amendment since it's in front of us.
There was also a motion before that still wasn't acted upon. Yes, and that's when we got... So I'm just trying to get us back. Who the hell is going to get the amendment?
I got you right. I'm going to sit back. Do you have other questions on regarding the CS?
Well, he's just going to use the last change.
The last change is a fairly minor one. It appears at page 2, lines 27 to 29. It was really just adding a few words. The statutory reference on line 29 really applies only to the duty of the prosecuting attorney to turn over things to the defense. This particular provision talks about the duty of the defense to turn over things to the prosecutor, and so the wording had to be changed to make it so that the duty is of the defense attorney to provide the prosecution with names of witnesses to the same extent and in the same manner as is required of the prosecution. So it's a slight change in wording to make, again, make the playing field level and to impose the same burden on both parties. To my recollection, those are the only changes from...
Would you look on page 2, lines 13 through 21, and see if that is a number?
That may have been moved on. Mr. Chairman, the previous version of the bill, which is work draft O, I believe also contains those same lines, the same place. So I think that has been carried through. I don't think that has been a change. It may very well have been a change from perhaps the immediately preceding version, but I don't think it's a change in the bill.
All right, is there further discussion on the adoption of the CS? If not, is there objection? Seeing none, the CS is adopted. Representative Thierry, could you state that amendment again?
Yes.
Thank you
very much. I appreciate your confidence. May the court record state that line 10, from past the word witness semicolon, be deleted to page up to line 11, semicolon, these experts. That error be deleted.
And that is on page 4?
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, that is on page 4. And on page 6, line 15, after witness period, the defendant shall delete that all the way to these experts on line 16 of page 6.
Is there a discussion of the amendment? Is there objection? Seeing none, amendment 1 passes. This committee may or may not have had that work draft that had this language on page 2 in it. Dean, could you explain to the committee what the intent of...
13 through, lines 13 through 21 on page 2.
On page 2, lines 13 through 21, it requires, as part of mandatory disclosure, that the defense let the prosecution know at least 10 days before trial if the defense is going to rely upon an alibi defense or some other defense mentioned in the statutes. If the defendant doesn't do that, the prosecution gets a continuance, or it can impose a more stringent sanction. This particular provision on these just nine lines was something that was recommended by the Criminal Rules Committee for the Supreme Court. It's a change that is currently being considered by the Supreme Court. This is one of those changes that we thought was a good idea to incorporate into the bill now, rather than running the risk of, in a couple of months, the Supreme Court changing its rule and there being some confusion over whether the legislature is, which rule the legislature is amending. But this is something that has been suggested by the Criminal Rules Committee for the Supreme Court. It's actually being submitted to the Bar Association for comment, and I expect it will be submitted to the Supreme Court shortly. But this was something that the Rules Committee for the Supreme Court recommended. That's the short answer to it.
Thank you very much. Are there any other people here that would like to give testimony on HB 25? If not, we'll conclude the public hearing. What is the wish of the committee? Is anything to say?
Two areas I still have the biggest problems with are the ones that I mentioned previously. I think the major burden occurring here when we prohibit the giving any of this information to the defendant themselves. I believe that the defendant has a right to access to this information, and the way it's going to occur if this bill were to pass is there's going to have to be some employee or the state or employee of the defense attorney who is going to sit down in a jail or whatever setting it is while a defendant goes through mounds of material. And if the goal is to restrict their access to this information, somehow it's not being served. They can sit and take notes off of any of it while it's there. There's nothing that prohibits that. If they want to sit there and scribble it all down bit by bit, they can get what they're after anyway. It seems to me we're throwing a procedural hurdle into the whole thing. Paperwork, as we know, runs our judicial system and our government as well. And I still can't reconcile. I mean, we've got all the protection in law now for the information that's intended to be confidential. I still can't understand why the other information can't be given to the defendant for the defendant to read. Besides the logical side of it and the sort of fairness, there's just the practical side of it as well. We have a fiscal note that's $250,000. And I assume most of it's attributable to, good portion at least is attributable to this particular problem. I had hoped there was some sort of middle ground out there that would achieve the purposes of the bill without this unnecessary hurdle. I don't know. I did speak briefly to the sponsor about it and hadn't heard back from him on that subject. So I have an amendment that I'll offer, but I had hoped, you know, the problem in all these kind of bills with our developing amendments is it's much better if we can get, you know, some of the ideas out of the Attorney General's office or others. When I come up with an amendment, it's just my best interpretation of what remarks have been said at the hearing. Mm-hmm. I'm not pretending to be an expert in discovery. That's certainly not the case.
I guess, Roger, you're not here, I'll...
Chairman?
Yes, Rich, please defer. Would you give us your name, then?
finance commitments. We had spoke with Representative Finkelstein and were entertaining some of the suggestions. Part in which, not specifically the one you just brought up, was also being dialogued with John Sloan with the Public Defender's Office. And I understand he just now was able to get us something in a written form as a request that I haven't seen officially, but I understand just came out today. And so we think it'd be appropriate to take some time to consider that as a compromise position. And so the sponsor would like to see perhaps the bill held in committee again while we work with public defenders, Senator Finkelstein, to consider these, which are worth considering.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, if that was the case, I would just turn over the copies of my amendments to the chair just for your consideration. But again, I think there's maybe a better way to do these than my...
If you would, give them to the sponsor.
Yeah. Well, they came from the sponsor.
Oh, okay. So you've got them, fine.
Well, I'll give them to
you. Okay. Just for the record, in my reading of the personal note, the problem that your amendment, this issue was seeking to address doesn't seem to be what the public defender has indicated is driving his personal note.
Mr. Chairman, I think I did ask specifically the personal notes, and he told me that this is due to his opinion that not everybody would opt in.
Yes.
If everybody opted in, there would be a zero personal note. So that's what he said was a reflection here.
As a matter of fact, the position of the one side of the issue and the Criminal Rules Committee's position and the public defender's personal note is driven by the assumption that people will not opt in, and the only state where there's been a track record on this, the facts seem to indicate that they do opt in, so I find these two assumptions a little bit incongruous. But in any event, we will hold the bill and look for the sponsor to work on that amendment. Dean, is there, before we leave it, is there any comment on that?
I think this comment is well taken. There are, I think, other provisions in the bill that they could probably be made for all their bill, they all use the same one, tends to.
Could you work with the sponsor on?
I will.
Great. Well, we will then continue this hearing until call of the chair when I'm notified that there's a student ready to go, but hopefully we'll understand it. Do we have a bill filed to sign on? The next bill that we have is HB 120, Identification of Public Employees. We have teleconference testimony, and the sponsor happens to have the floor right now, so I'll be happy to introduce this bill to you.
Okay,
I'll get that later. This bill, many of you, well, all of you, should remember as it passed the House last year. It passed through committees in the Senate and died in rules, as so many other otherwise excellent pieces of work in the House did. Getting a quicker start, maybe we can overcome that problem. Basically, it provides to the rest of the public employees in this state privileges that are already accrued to most of the public employees of the state, either by law or by employee agreement. It basically allows public employees not otherwise covered to be indemnified from damages that were accrued because of an act or omission that they may have that may have occurred as a result, a direct result of their employment. As is indicated, it is a balancing position. It will allow employees to be indemnified for negligent acts, but not to be indemnified specifically for reckless or intentional acts. These protections are now provided to most of the represented employees of the state and many municipalities. They are provided by statute to employees of the university, our municipal school districts, and REAs. So
I think that probably gives you a pretty good foundation of what it does. Representative Easy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was trying to remember the discussion we had in this bill last year. I think you just summarized it. Currently, all state employees are indemnified, and all University of Alaska employees are indemnified.
All state employees are not indemnified. We'll have testimony probably better than mine on how that breaks out. All university, municipal school districts, and IAs are covered by statute. Many state employees are covered by...
You say all municipalities?
School districts.
School districts.
Not municipalities. There is a letter in your packet indicating from, for example, my community, Anchorage, that this is a policy of the city. And they certainly support the statute, so in effect they are providing it. But I guess we may or may not get a testimony, but it was evident from testimony last year. One of the problems, and I'll admit to a little personal bias here, one of the problems that you find is that if you are mid-management, which often is the category that is not covered because they're not in a union and they're not one of these other categories that's covered by law, standard mid-management bureaucrat gets himself named in a suit just because he's kind of in the line of responsibility within an organization chart. And then that stays with him for years. I just got, about a year and a half ago, my name off the last suit from the Anchorage Police Department, that, and I retired in 87.
You're lucky.
Yeah. But the adverse effect of that, of course, is that you can be trying to get a mortgage on your house, and all of a sudden you find that you're at risk because you're named in a suit that's got a request for $5 million, punitive damages or something. It just gives you rise. In any event, we have three people to testify, and a couple more here, I think. So, could we get you a... Have you signed?
Okay. I apologize.
Great. Would you please? But while that's going on, could I ask if Scott Brad Erickson is available in Anchorage?
Yes, I am. This is Scott Brad Erickson.
Scott, could you give us your affiliation and your testimony, please?
I'm listening to Chris Latour's office in Anchorage. And I'm testifying on behalf of my office, not on behalf of the Municipality of Anchorage. Anchorage is still working on its official legislative program. And while in the proposed program, there's a statement included supporting this bill, it has not been formally approved. Ms. Lachenda's office supports this bill and would urge its passage. With the other benefits from this bill, one would be that it would establish some clear rules regarding how defense and indemnification of employees is handled. It's similar to the current practice, but provides some advantageous elements. Among them, there's a clear authorization in the bill to manage period damage claims. They're easy for a plaintiff to assert, but they pose certain problems for a public employer to defend, because the public employer itself is immune from liability for punitive damages, but the individual employees may be liable if the facts of the case support it. An additional advantage, there are obligations set forth in the bill on the part of the employee to cooperate with the defense of the case. So you don't have a situation where the employer agrees to indemnify the employee, and then the employee assists the plaintiff in getting more money out of the public employer. Also, an advantage, and I believe it's new in this year's iteration of the bill, is the clear authority of the employer to settle without the consent of the employee. If the employer is the one who is paying the cost of the lawsuit, this provision makes sense and prevents a situation where the employee could hold out the employer's or prevent the employer's ability to settle losses due to some other considerations, whether it be offended sensibilities or personal reasons that the employee might have if they wouldn't want the case settled. And finally, because of the way it clearly spells out the responsibilities and the obligations of the employer and the employee, it would limit the conflict between the employer and employee when it comes to lawsuits that allege claims against public employees in court and scope of their duties. I'm available for questions concerning the bill if you have any, and that concludes my testimony.
Scott, thank you very much. I see no questions. You were very clear and concise. Let's see if I can pronounce this name correctly, Dwayne Udland. Is he available in Anchorage?
Yes, my name is Dwayne Udland. I'm the chief of the Anchorage Police Department, and I'd like to thank Representative Porter for bringing this back again, and also Representative Toohey for signing on with this. So I hope that this bill don't get through this year. Us leading from the public sector on indemnification have been for several years as we've tried to get this through the legislature, is that we're not asking for immunity for employees, but what we are asking for is protection when we're doing the work of government, and that we not have to live in fear that we can't get loans for a house or for a boat or for a car because we have a lawsuit that's filed against us. And anybody who's ever been named personally in a suit can tell you how you start to shake and shudder, and you read your name in that lawsuit, you find that now all of a sudden you may have to pay up millions of dollars if you're guilty or alleged in a complaint. And even though that rarely happens, it is a very chilling effect. And one of the, I think, the very sad byproducts that has come across, is going across this country right now, is the sort of gridlock we see in government. And part of it has to do with the intense fear that public officials have of the liability that goes with the decision-making process. And again, I'd like to reassure everybody, we're not asking for protection if we make reckless or malicious decisions, and we never argue for that. But we're trying to make good faith decisions on behalf of the public. All we're asking for is that our employer have to protect us if we have a suit filed against us. And unfortunately, many cities do not have that. Many employees work under policies that change from time to time, and there is a tremendous amount of fear out there, particularly as you see cases across the country that more and more are holding individuals accountable for actions that they take at the behest of their employer. So I'm assuming it's going to pass through the House again this year, and I hope it does, and I'll just try it out and answer any questions if you'd like.
Thank you, Dwayne. One question, Representative Bundy?
Just a clarification that, as I understand it, and I would just like the record to reflect that this does not indemnify against gross negligence and that level of behavior.
That is correct. That is correct. It specifically excludes that coverage from. Okay, seeing none, thank you, Dwayne. Is Gail Voigtlander?
Yes, I am present.
Gail, could we have your affiliation and your testimony, please?
Yes, I'm Assistant Attorney General here in Anchorage, and I've been asked to just outline the legal concepts that are involved in this bill. And first of all, the bill as it's currently drafted. The bill actually is fairly user-friendly, and most of the terms that one would otherwise require definitions for, the definitions are found in the bill. Indemnification is actually defined in the bill as being paid settlements and judgments, including the attorney's fees and costs entered against the employee. So when we're talking about indemnification, that's the concept that's being dealt with. This bill covers civil claims against employees of public employers. There are the bill itself is to cover after omissions that occur during the course and within the scope of the employee's employment with the public employer. There are several exceptions or clarifications within the bill that delineate where there it is not intended that there be defense or indemnification of the public employee. The public employer is not obligated to defend or indemnify if the acts or omissions of the, which is just saying what they did or what they failed to do, were the result of gross negligence, intentional misconduct, or willful misconduct. And gross negligence as a concept in Alaska law, as well as elsewhere, has been defined as the same thing as recklessness. It's the same standard. There's also, what is not covered by the bill, are claims that involve disciplinary, administrative, or criminal matters that are brought against the employee or where the employee is appealing from any of these matters. Those are specifically not in the public employer's obligations to defend or indemnify. again, another session is if the civil claim or action that is being brought against the public employee is based on conduct for which the employee has been convicted of criminal offense, or is based upon the same conduct which has caused them to be terminated from their employment. It also excludes defense or indemnification of public employees if the employee settled or compromised the claim before requesting legal defense or indemnification from the public employer, or if that employee were to do that while the request is pending. That would be if the they're served with a lawsuit, they haven't given notice to the public employer that they are requesting defense or indemnification, and they go ahead and settle the claim with the plaintiff in the case. What the bill does is set out, as Mr. Grant Erickson stated, the clear lines of what each party's obligations are, what the employer's obligations are, what the employee's obligations are. There's one other area that sometimes people have questions about, and that's the area of the bill that deals with where the employer provides a legal defense, the public employer provides a legal defense, but with a reservation of rights. And all that's intended by the reservation of rights, and in fact, again, it's, the language is found right within the bill, is where the public employer places limitations on the agreement to indemnify the employee pending the outcome of the case. So they go ahead and defend that employee in the lawsuit, but place limitations on their agreement as to the scope or the extent to which they will indemnify the employee against a judgment that is not favorable against the employee. Those are the basic concepts that are covered by the bill. That would complete my testimony, and can respond to any questions about the legal effects of the provisions in this bill.
Okay, Gail, thank you very much. That finger isn't a... Well, okay. There are no questions. Gail, thank you very much. We have two people here in Juneau, but I wanted to ask before we leave if Mike Corkill is patient enough to have hung around all this time in Fairbanks?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm still here.
Oh, Mike, welcome back. Could we get your testimony, please?
Yes, my name is Mike Corkill. I'm representing the Peace Officers Association. Relating to this, I'd like to echo a lot of the same testimony given by Duane Utland. This joint leadership point is that government should be held accountable, responsible for its actions. I firmly believe, and our organization believes, that when someone's wrongfully harmed through actions of the government or one of its employees, that the injured party should be able to make claims as appropriate. However, we do believe that government employees or public employees should be defended and protected, especially when their actions are made in good faith without malice. I believe this bill does set that out very, very clearly. And one point is on page 2, line 2, where it talks about the acts or admissions at issue are a result of gross negligence. Potential role of this kind of party employee, that does set out times when the government or the public employer would not have a responsibility to represent the employee who's alleged to commit the act. Having been a person who's been subject to lawsuit in the course of employment as a law enforcement officer before, it is a very disconcerting thing to have your name attached to something like that, knowing or pursuing a lawsuit can get your personal property, and in fact your personal life in many ways, and does not sit right with many people. And at times can cause them, when we're in a position to react very, very quickly to any emergency at hand, can sometimes cause a bit of a hesitancy for those people, despite how lengthy their training is, thinking that, well, my God, what I may do or may not do might end up affecting me and my family for as long as I live. And by having an indemnification bill along these lines would help protect a person from these sort of fears. That's all for my testimony.
I see no questions. Mike, thank you very much again. for the adjustment.
One question about
we have a question. Representative Vesey.
Yes, if I may, is it the policy of the city of Fairbanks, and if you know the borough, Fairbanks North Star Borough, to indemnify their employees?
Mr. Vesey, I can't testify to that. I am a state employee, though I am
testifying
on behalf of
the Alaska Peace Association.
I'm sorry, thank you.
It's my understanding from recollection last year that that is the case, that they do as a policy, and some of their union agreements have it in. The problem, of course, is that policies change every time you change mayors and or city managers, I guess you can. Okay, we have two people here in Anchorage, or here in Juneau. First, Kevin Ritchie with AML. Welcome, Kevin.
Kevin Ritchie is the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League, and the league supported HB 277 last year, and we support the bill this year. As a former city manager, I've been on both sides, both as an employee and employer, and in looking over the language, I'm impressed that it's very comprehensive, easy to understand, and I think has very balanced in terms of how it protects both the employer, the employee, and actually the public in a lot of cases. So with that, I'd answer any questions, and we do support passage of the bill.
Representative Vesey.
Does this mean that you are not going to always not support unfunded mandates? Or?
Actually, as I was sitting there, I was looking at unfunded mandates and thinking about that issue. And at a time in the future, that would be really worthy of discussion. It's a long discussion on the role of state government, local government, and the interactions.
Well, I think that's really what we're saying here. We're not just making a law covering state employees and subdivisions of, well, they are political subdivisions, but we're taking this down to political subdivisions, autonomous units. We're mandating a policy on them, but we're not funding it. That's the question for us, to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beasley, in this particular case, in thinking about that very question, this, to my knowledge, is the most cost-effective way of dealing with a particular issue, with this particular issue. And I think one of the former people testified that there's a lot of fear out in among employees at times, and also when these types of standards aren't followed, it's also likely to cost the municipality or the state or whoever pursues a different course more than if they had followed along these guidelines, which are fairly standard types of approaches. And so in this particular case, it's sort of like municipalities enforce the state criminal code. You know, and obviously you need a criminal code for the state, and police departments obviously enforce that. That is a mandate, but it's one that is you just have to do on a statewide basis, and I would classify this probably in the same category. Though it is a mandate, it's an acceptable mandate.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having been on both sides of the fence, as you indicated, that would relieve a lot of potential bias. Can you give a, not to do any, but to just kind of go through the mind exercise of hypotheticals, what ifs, that by having this enacted, that there would be cases where individuals would have preferred not to have been settled on a class action type, they would have preferred to do their own so that they wouldn't be dragged in the settlement against their own wishes. In playing that what-if game, is it your opinion that the very few times that might be an issue is far outweighed by the benefit?
Yes, I played some of the what-if games with Mr. Thompson, who will testify next, and most of the situations that I could come up with, an individual who felt very strongly could defend themselves, and by the same token, an individual who was not being defended by their employer but wanted to be had options, and the employer had options to defend somebody they didn't really want to defend. There's lots of situations, and they seem to be reasonably covered in this bill.
Thank you. See you. Any questions, Kevin? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Peace to Resistance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brad Thompson. I'm the director of the Division of Risk Management within the Department of Administration. And I'll keep my testimony very quick. Well, this bill codifies the existing practice that the state provides to its employees. The majority of our employees are provided in collective bargaining agreements, defense commitments or contractual statements to say things like this, but not in as clear a form as is presented in this bill. And I think that this is a document that's worked out over the past two sessions, I believe, and it has had a lot of massaging. The words now are fairly clear. It's a complex subject, but yet it does show to both the employer and the employee the provisions and conditions that are provided. And it is our practice, and we support it. And I'd be happy to answer questions.
Mayor, thank you very much. Representative Beasley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill would codify practice regarding state employees, but the state has a lot of officials doing work for it. I'm thinking primarily in terms of boards and commissions. We have some 120 boards and commissions and some thousand commissioners and board members. And it is a practice of the state to identify their commissioners who get sued with the frequency that you probably know more than I. But we're not codifying that practice.
Actually, in the definition of employee in this bill, it would extend to members of boards or commissions established by the employer.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
So I believe it will provide.
Are there any other questions abroad? If not, thank you very much, Brad. That concludes the testimony. Is there anyone else here or on the teleconference network that wishes to provide testimony on HB 120? Seeing none, we'll conclude the public hearing. And what is the wish of the committee? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that House Bill 120, Issue C or Version C, be moved down to committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
And a motion to move individual recommendations and fiscal notes is attached, which by the way is zero, yes. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Yeah. Thank you very much. The bill is moved.
Good work.
And I think
fiscal notes, three. Administration, law, risk management. Okay.
Oh, great. Thanks. Did you get three?
Three.
What do we got? All right. Microphone.
Oh, no, I'm fine.
We have, last but not least, consideration of CS for HB 42. Which is the absentee voting by fax bill that Tom Anderson, representing Representative Martin, will tell us all about right now. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Chairman Porter, members of the committee, and like Representative Parnell in the earlier bill, Representative Martin is unable to attend, and I'll break precedent and keep this under an hour. My introductory speech. HB 42 is almost a mirror image of HB 49, last year's fax bill from Representative Martin, and it enables and allows voters, absentee voters specifically, who apply within 4 days of an election, and they can do this by fax, to receive a ballot and vote on a ballot and send it back by facsimile, electronic transmission. And last year, Representative Brown and some other legislators in the House expanded this. Initially, we had it just for out-of-country absentee voters, and now, through their help and some pushing and prodding from Alaska Federation of Natives and Access Alaska and some seniors, we have expanded it to every level. So whether you're out of your district in another, you know, in another side of the town, or if you're out of the city that you vote in, but in state, or if you're out of state, but in the United States, or out of country in Africa or South America, you can vote by fax if you follow the parameters of, you know, the four-day deadline to fax your application back in and get a signature by either, we have it in here, either two U.S. citizens or someone in the military or an official of a state. And other than that, I think the bill died in the Senate last year. I think with the mad rush of bills going through both houses, and it looks like we have a lot of support this year, and you can see the letters of support in your packet, and we have more coming. The Federation of Natives had a glowing letter last year and have not had a meeting this year to respond to this, but we believe it'll be positive as well. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There seems to be one word on page 2, line 16, that I'm not sure if it's the right word. It's over there. It seems like it ought to be an and. Everyone who submits an absentee ballot has got to include their address, and but the implication is with the or that if they send in the absentee ballot, they actually don't have to include their address. They just have to include their whatever fax number they happen to be using that day. Is that the intent of it, or is it just, am I just misreading it?
I think Division of Elections requested that, considering there's a potential that addresses change with, like, let's say, military movement. We could certainly put that in. No problem.
Representative Green?
Well, maybe I'm missing something there, because the way I read this, it says that you'll give your address like you normally would, but this says you will give the address to which you want the absentee ballot sent. And with the insertion of this, you may not have an address. You may want it sent to a fax.
That's correct, but I think Representative Finkelstein is correct, too, that it could be misleading. I don't think that problem would occur because, again, the specific intent is to show that you have a fax number and you're not living out of state. I mean, you could be traveling and you may not have an address, and I think that was the impetus behind that. If you're out on business, you don't have, what do you put the Holiday Inn address? No.
Representative Beasy?
If I understand the line of Representative Green's questioning, Representative Green is kind of implying that in his opinion it would be better if the word or on line 16 was and?
No, just the opposite. I think it should stay or.
Representative Finkelstein.
Representative Finkelstein thinks it should be and.
And could you tell us more about that assertion? Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I may be in the wrong part. The thing I'm concerned about is that the form require the same information, whether it's submitted by fax or by mail. So maybe that's in another section, and maybe it isn't necessary to have the address here. Because the whole issue, having watched a lot of these close elections, what's on the face of the absentee ballot is extremely critical and has come about through many court decisions and changes in the law. And I think we certainly don't want to be messing with that, I don't think. But I don't, it may not be in this statute where what is covered. I guess that's the question that it comes down to, is the same set of information is covered on the face of the ballot request. And the ballot itself, I suppose. Is that the same information when you're voting by fax as by voting by mail? And if so, where does it say that?
Well, I'm not sure anybody's on the election.
Very good.
You might want to reiterate the
retirement. Come on up here. Could you give us your name and affiliation for the record, please?
Okay. My name is David Koivunimi, spelled K-O-I, V as in Victor, U, N-I-E-M-I. I'm the acting director of the Division of Elections. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, I didn't hear the whole question.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to figure out where in law we continue to require the same information on the face of the ballot request and the ballot jacket that we do for a faxed ballot as we do for mailed ballots. My concern came out of a section where we removed the requirement for the inclusion of address, but I assume it's required somewhere else.
The fax application, well, an absentee ballot, they have to give us the information, including their resident address and things like that. But as far as...
Do you have the bill in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Could you look at page 2,
Okay. Section 2 on line 14.
Okay.
What we are hoping this doesn't mean is that there, if you vote by fax, you don't have to provide your address on the face of the ballot itself. What we presume this means, and one always is questioned about presumptions, is that if it is that you want your absentee ballot mailed to you, you have to give the address to mail it to, and if you want it faxed to you, you have to give the fax number with which to fax it to. And that's all that that means. It doesn't change the requirements for providing information on the face of the absentee ballot.
Well, as far as, you know, how we're going to do that, I can't answer that right now. It probably wouldn't be on the face of the ballot. It would be like a separate document or something like that that they'd have to attach to the ballot, you know. Instead of putting it in the envelope and providing all that information on the face of the envelope, we'll have to have them, you know, fill out a separate form with all particular information. So my presumption right now is that we would still require that they give us a resident address so that we could actually identify who they are and that they are qualified, what ballot they're qualified to vote,
yeah,
and, you know, what portion of the ballot, you know, would be counted. Based upon the address that they gave us, you know, and the address that they're registered at.
Great.
So I don't see any change as far as doing it any differently by fax as we would, you know, the requirements as by.
Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's supported if you look at line 19, which still, as is current law, requires that the applicants full Alaska residence address be included. I think that's what you were addressing, isn't it, Representative?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Finkelstein?
No, that it's on the ballot, you've actually got to include your out-of-state address if you're sending in for an absentee ballot. It's one of the requirements is what you're, is to include your out-of-state. That's the current requirement if you're trying to get a ballot mailed to you. You have to have an address. And so that's an additional. You might be in Alaska, but you might be over in Honolulu or something. And so you'd give the address there. And what I'm getting from David is that would still be required. It's just not listed here somewhere else.
Well, the way I read this is that all we're doing is adding to the requirements that if you do request your application by fax, that you also give us a fax number where it's supposed to be transmitted. And other than that, nothing else would be changed in the statute.
That's
what
I
read that.
Too, exactly, just to add the phone number.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that's the intent, is that if you weren't going to be able to do balloting by fax, they have to have an address. I mean, you have to prove that you're an Alaskan, which is still there, and then they have to have some place to send the ballot to. And this says, okay, you can have that sent to your address, but if you insert, you would prefer to do it by fax, give us a fax number we can send the ballot to. So it's not really subverting anything that's required. That just says, hey, we got to be able to get a ballot to you.
It's probably a lot of unnecessary language in the statute. If somebody asks for fax ballots, I mean, you're going to have a number to send it to, or it isn't going to happen. But anyway, we do that a lot. You know what I'm saying,
Bonnie? It's not particularly germane to this bill, just a question as long as we're discussing absentee ballots. Just take a hypothetical. Someone lives in my district, moves out of state, maintains their Alaska residency, and wishes to continue voting. What district would they vote in if they no longer live in District 18?
Yeah,
as
long as they retain their residency in Alaska, in, you know, their last address in Alaska, it would be still in the last district that we have information on them.
So someone who's in the military is transferred out. They were voting in, say they were on Fort Rich and they were voting that district.
Mm-hmm.
They must continue to vote that district. They cannot just...
Unless they take some other action to change their Alaska residence address, yes. They would always remain in, it's District 14 actually, so they would always remain in that district as far, until, you know, we have some indication that of their desire to change that.
I've just been curious about this. So they're out of state, they don't come back and they say, well, I no longer going to be a non-resident of 18, I'm going to be a non-resident of 10. Can they simply sing their
they have to establish their residency.
Otherwise you could gerrymander some kind
of Mr. I'm sure, having followed elections procedures for years, the moment they write on the new address, stating a new address as their Alaskan residence, it gets changed by your division automatically.
That's correct.
You don't have to prove anything. Representative Bunny is correct that you just decree that I now move to some new place, and that's the new place you're in. You don't have to come back to the state. You don't have to do anything. You just decide whatever your affiliation
is. You essentially vote whatever district you think is going to be a close race.
Object.
But that is the case.
Wait a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is not exactly the way it works, because your change of address does not go into effect. You have to change your address 30 days before an election. So if you send in a ballot, you will vote at your old address until the next election.
Right. But Representative Finkelstein is correct. The presumption is that you know, we have to accept their sworn statement that, you know, they have established a new residency wherever they tell us.
And in any event, this is not going to affect this bill.
No.
So, well, it's an interesting discussion. Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My concern is on privacy of the ballots. It's easy for me to see the faxing of the request for the ballot, but now someone's actually sending in the ballot, and what's the... And we've got privacy of the ballot problems at two ends. We've got at one end, if somebody goes, and very few of us actually operate fax machines. Often there are other people who operate fax machines. You turn it over to someone, and they... What's to prevent there the lost privacy of the ballot or even tampering, and then the receipt at the other end at your division, where somebody is going to be receiving these ballots, and on the face of it, it says what their name is and who they voted for.
Mr. Chairman, as far as from the sending in, you know, we have absolutely no control over, you know, who actually sends it or anything. We have no control over, you know, by mail ballots right now under the same circumstance. As far as on our receiving end, you are correct that somebody will actually see the ballot. And I don't, you know, I'm sure it's not going to be somebody standing there, you know, reviewing every ballot or anything like that. But, yeah, somebody will have to physically handle the ballot, take it off the machine, put it in an envelope and attached, you know, whatever backup information we require. So that my understanding is the purpose of the waiver language in the bill. And that's the best that we can do on that. But, yes, somebody will see the ballot.
And real quickly also, Tom Anderson speaking, that this isn't a substitute, I mean, you know, for mailing. And the idea is that we don't want millions and millions, in this case thousands, of absentee ballots to be faxed in. But it's an alternative in case there is a time crunch or in case someone is disabled or out of town. So I don't think the calculation of numbers is going to escalate extremely high. And last year in Judiciary, thanks to Representative Porter, Chairman Porter, the Attorney General's office came and testified and said that the bottom line is, if you're in a time crunch or there is difficulty through the mail and you were to fax your ballot, the ability to vote outweighs the one individual seeing the response. So that was verbal, not written. But
Thank you. I appreciate the answer. And the problem, of course, is that many people will do this. I mean, we have no idea how common it will become, and it won't necessarily be because of a time crunch or other things. It may just become the way people vote. And so we've got it, and it may be thousands, it may be